Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, July 7th. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Jack Palmer, reading international, national, and local news and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, MAGA Eyes New Steps Regarding Birthright Citizenship, written by Zach Anderson. Some prominent conservatives suggested there could be a need for extreme measures, including impeaching judges, sterilizing foreign visitors, and dissolving the union in the wake of a Supreme Court decision upholding birthright citizenship. The court found Trump's executive order last year targeting birthright citizenship was invalid under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which states, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. The ruling sparked widespread outrage on the right, which has rallied around President Donald Trump's push to restrict the constitutional provision granting automatic citizenship to anyone born in the country. Sean Davis, the CEO and co-founder of the Federalist online magazine, wrote on social media, there are several ways forward after the ruling, among them adding more justices to the Supreme Court and mandating sterilization of all foreign visitors prior to entry. Davis also mentioned dissolving the union, writing, a nation which can't even restrict who gets to be a citizen isn't a nation. Jack Posobiec, another conservative media figure, said in a social media post that the court never said we can't mandate spot pregnancy tests for foreigners. Many on the right lashed out at conservative justices who joined the majority decision. Impeach rogue activist judges, Representative Nancy Mace, Representative of South Carolina, wrote on social media. We're looking at you, Amy Coney Barrett. The outpouring of anger on the right spurred pushback from some other conservatives. The right-wing meltdown over the citizen case is shockingly dishonest, wrote Greg Nunziata, an aide for President of State Marco Rubio when he was in the Senate and now the executive director of the Society for the Rule of Law, a group founded by conservative legal figures from previous Republican administrations. The ruling preserves the status quo, Nunziata added. The court majority landed where most conservative scholarship has been. Trump has pushed a hardline immigration agenda centered around mass deportations, but targeting birthright citizenship may have been his most aggressive move. It clashed with how the Constitution has long been understood and sought to dramatically redefine who gets to be a citizen. Trump was deeply invested in the case, attending Supreme Court arguments, a first for a sitting president. The president described birthright citizenship as an anchor wrapped around the country's neck. But Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, said, citizenship, then and now, was the right to have rights, to freely participate in our political community. The framers of the 14th Amendment extended that promise to every freeborn person in this land. We keep that promise today, Roberts added. The loss had some conservatives lamenting about a path forward. Vice President J.D. Vance, appearing on Fox News, said the ruling was a major, major mistake, but noted it had a silver lining. It showed there is significant support among the justices for ending birthright citizenship, which Vance said is hanging by a thread. Four of the justices said Trump's executive order didn't violate the 14th Amendment, although one said it violated a 1952 immigration law. We have to keep fighting because we actually have an opportunity to reverse this decision, Vance said. The next article is titled, Drought and Heat Wave Raise Water Concerns, written by Janine Santucci. Americans across the nation are being asked or ordered to conserve water thanks to widespread drought made even worse by a punishing heat wave. It's being felt this summer in Virginia, the Carolinas, Pennsylvania, Colorado, New Jersey, and more. Take shorter showers. Turn the water off while you brush your teeth. Don't wash your car at home or water your lawn. These are some of the asks of residents in communities around the country. Some asks are voluntary, while other areas have outright banned water wasting with threats of fines. Meanwhile, agriculture uses far more water than households in the United States. So does your shorter shower or unwatered lawn actually make a difference? Yes, but it's complicated, said Shimon Anisfield, a water conservation expert at Yale School of the Environment and the author of Water Management, Prioritizing Justice and Sustainability. Household water comes from a limited supply, often unrelated and closed off from the vast agricultural water supply. Though that setup varies by region, local governments often do actually need people's help to protect their limited residential water supply. The bottom line, Anisfield said, for a shorter shower to make a difference, everyone needs to get on board. It's just like voting. Any one vote doesn't matter, but collectively, voting matters, he said. If you live in a city of 1 million people, your 15% cut in water use isn't going to save the city. But if everybody does it, or half the people do it, then you really have an effect. As of July 2nd, the U.S. Drought Monitor recorded that nearly half of the continental United States, 48%, is in at least a moderate stage of drought, and more than 30% is classified as at least severe drought. Regions with the worst drought conditions include the West, where wildfires have been raging, parts of the High Plains, the Southeast, and the Mid-Atlantic region. Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger is urging all state residents, and especially those in southern and central Virginia, to conserve water as the drought creates challenges for communities and farmers across the state. For example, residents are asked to turn off faucets while brushing teeth, washing hands, and shaving. Water lawns only when necessary and before 10 a.m. to reduce evaporation. Take shorter showers and baths. Use a commercial car wash instead of washing cars at home. Wash only full loads of laundry and dishes. Fix leaky pipes and running toilets. Reuse water for metering plants or cleaning instead. But in some places, water restrictions are no longer voluntary. In Raleigh, North Carolina, for example, there have been 748 violations of water restrictions as of June 29th, Raleigh Water Assistant Director Edward Buchan told USA Today in an email. Violators get warning letters before fines, but ultimately, water may be disconnected. On a local scale, water consumption is broken up into three categories: household use, industrial or commercial use, that is restaurants, hospitals, factories, and the like, and non-revenue water, firefighting water, and things like leaks in the system, Annisfield said. In most cities, household use is the biggest of the three. In some regions, a lot of that household use is made up of outdoor use, like for watering lawns and filling pools. In wetter climates where residents don't have to water their lawns, indoor use, such as for showers, is more impactful. When water restrictions are in place, the mandatory ones tend to be focused on outdoor use, but cities and counties still urge residents to also voluntarily conserve indoors. Showers can actually be the biggest single water use in the house, Annisfield said, noting newer appliances like dishwashers and washing machines use less water than they once did. Showers have become actually relatively more important as everything else has gotten efficient. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the average shower time in the United States is about 8 minutes and uses about 16 gallons of water. More than 1 trillion gallons of water are used every day in the country on showering alone. If every person reduced their shower time, the nation could save 170 billion gallons of water each year, the EPA said. Though it might seem counterintuitive that reduced showers, limited residential lawn watering, and washing laundry only with full loads could make an impact when these uses don't come close to the amount used in agriculture, Annisfield said. The water supply for municipal use is different from the supply for agriculture, and they can't be interchanged. It's different water, he said. For one thing, city water is treated so it can be safely consumed, while agricultural water isn't. Also, how much water municipalities get to use is governed by states' various water rights or laws on how they decide to allocate water. Depending on where you live, reallocating water from agricultural to municipal use in a water shortage would be difficult, if not impossible, both legally and physically, he said. In some parts of the country, entire new pipe systems would have to be built. Another water use controversy comes from data centers increasingly used to fuel artificial intelligence, which use huge amounts of water and can drive up utility rates for nearby residents. Large data centers can consume up to 5 million gallons of water a day, according to the Environmental and Energy Study Institute. That's as much as a small town. An analysis published by The Guardian found that hundreds of planned AI data centers are expected to be built in areas experiencing drought. And often, Annisfield said, data centers are pulling from municipal water supplies. Though data centers use a small fraction of the overall U.S. water supply, Annisfield said, if you've got a large data center and you have a drought, you may get those messages that really piss people off because they understand they're being asked to sacrifice for something they didn't ask for necessarily. The next article is titled, Charlie Kirk Family Grieves as Hearing Gets Underway, written by Stephanie Murray. The preliminary hearing in Charlie Kirk's murder case will be a painful reminder of his death, his family said in a joint statement. Prosecutors were set to lay out their case against Tyler Robinson, the Utah man accused of assassinating Kirk, at a preliminary hearing beginning July 6th. Charlie was a beloved husband, son, brother, friend, and father. Every court proceeding serves as a painful reminder of his death and the loss that has irrevocably impacted our lives and the lives of his children, Kirk's immediate family said in a written statement on the morning of the hearing. The written statement was issued on behalf of his widow, Erica Kirk, his parents, Robert and Catherine, and his sister, Mary. Kirk, a father of two young children, was the co-founder of Turning Point, the Phoenix-based network of conservative political groups. He was 31 when he was shot and killed at a Turning Point event on the Utah Valley University campus in September 2025. Erica, Robert, and Catherine Kirk were expected to attend the preliminary hearing in Utah, according to a source familiar with the situation. During the five-day hearing in Utah's 4th Judicial District Court, prosecutors were set to show a judge why they believe Robinson should stand trial for Kirk's murder. The threshold is lower than a full criminal trial. The judge will decide whether prosecutors have shown probable cause that a crime was committed and that Robinson likely committed it. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty. As the hearing loomed, Kirk's family expressed gratitude for the support they had received from the public. "We remain deeply grateful for the support, prayers, and kindness we have received. This outpouring has sustained us during the darkest days of our lives," the Kirk family said. In the days after Kirk was killed, tens of thousands of people packed into State Farm Stadium in Glendale for a public memorial that included Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and top members of his cabinet. Erica Kirk forgave her father's accused killer in an emotional speech at the memorial. Trump called Kirk's assassin a radicalized, cold-blooded monster. Kirk's death also exposed a divide in the nation, with some mocking his death, celebrating it, or expressing indifference. Kirk was a leading conservative voice and popular podcaster known for making comments that some found controversial. Kirk's slaying has also become the subject of conspiracy theories online. Erica Kirk said in December that she believed Robinson was the person who killed her husband. Kirk's family said they are feeling immense grief and requested privacy as the hearing gets underway. "Out of respect for the judicial process, we will not be commenting further at this time. We ask for continued privacy as we navigate this process and immense grief," the Kirk family said. The next article is titled, "National Guard Members Shoot and Kill Man in Tennessee," written by Lucas Finton, Jack Armstrong, and Tao Nguyen. Two members of the Tennessee National Guard fatally shot a man early July 5th during a pursuit in downtown Memphis, officials said. In a statement to the Memphis Commercial Appeal, part of the USA Today network, the Memphis Police Department said officers responded to a shots fired call in the downtown area shortly before 4 a.m. local time. After arriving at the scene, police said officers saw several people leaving the area and observed an armed male carrying a handgun. The man, who was later identified by the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation as 20-year-old Tyrin Johnson, fled on foot and was pursued by officers along with guard members who were assigned to the area, according to police. During the pursuit, police said Johnson turned toward the guard members with his weapon. "For reasons under investigation, the situation escalated, resulting in two National Guard soldiers firing upon Johnson, striking and killing him. State police said in a statement, "No law enforcement officers were hurt." Johnson had reportedly fired shots in the area, according to the state police. Guard spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Darren Haas said two Guard medical specialists attempted first aid, but Johnson was pronounced dead at the scene. Haas said the Guard members were in the city as part of the Memphis Safe Task Force, established by the Trump administration to combat crime in the city. The task force did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Shelby County District Attorney Steve Mulroy confirmed to the Commercial Appeal that two Guard members were involved in the incident and said he called the state police to look into the circumstances of the shooting. Last year, President Donald Trump deployed Guard troops and federal agents to Democratic-led cities, including Memphis. The Trump administration cited crime and protests as reasons for the deployments, despite objections from local leaders. The Guard has been in Memphis since October. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee had welcomed the federal intervention, while Memphis Mayor Paul Young said he did not support the deployment of the Guard. The Guard's deployment to Memphis has been subject to a lawsuit filed by a group of Democratic officials from the local and state level. A Davidson County Chancery Court judge initially granted a temporary injunction against the deployment, but that injunction was later struck down by a panel of appellate judges. The temporary injunction would have required the Guard to withdraw from Memphis pending the outcome of the case. The shooting is the fourth one involving a member of the task force in Memphis and the third fatal shooting by a member of the task force. In May, a Drug Enforcement Administration agent fatally shot a 41-year-old man, and a week later, a Homeland Security Investigations special agent shot and killed a 25-year-old man. The next article is titled, "Report Targets Leaders of U.S. History Museum," written by Tao Nguyen. A new White House report accuses leaders of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History of embracing extreme political activism and using the nation's flagship history museum to advance what the report describes as an ideological agenda. The 162-page report, released July 4th by the White House Domestic Policy Council, is part of the Trump administration's ongoing review of the Smithsonian and is the latest move in the Trump administration's broader push to scrutinize Smithsonian exhibits and programming that federal officials view as overly ideological or woke. The report argues that museum leaders have moved the institution away from historical scholarship and toward social justice advocacy, saying the museum now presents U.S. history largely through themes of racism, oppression, and inequality. This ideological capture has moved the museum's mission away from straightforward historical education and scholarship toward an extreme political activism that seeks to transform our country, the report states. Much of the report focuses on historian Anthea Hartig, who has led the National Museum of American History since 2019 and is the museum's first female director. The White House cites Hartig's public statements describing history as a prime tool of social justice, connecting scholarship to activism and advocacy, and working to reframe the traditional celebratory narrative of U.S. history. The report argues that the museum has de-emphasized America's founding, noting the absence of major exhibits devoted to the Founding Fathers or key events of the American Revolution as the country marked its 250th anniversary. It also criticizes museum programs and exhibits addressing race, immigration, and gender identity, contending they prioritize advocacy over traditional historical interpretation. For more than 180 years, the Smithsonian has served the American public with nonpartisan and independent scholarship, and we remain committed to doing so, a spokesperson for the Smithsonian said in a statement to USA Today. In a March 2025 executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, President Donald Trump objected to what he called a concerted effort to downplay American successes and to cast historical milestones and the nation's founding principles in a negative light. Then, in August 2025, the Trump administration launched a review of the Smithsonian, which operates 21 museums, the National Zoo, and multiple research centers, beginning with 8 of its most visited and highest profile museums. Federal officials also identified a series of exhibits and programs they said reflected ideological or divisive interpretations of American history. Critics have argued that such efforts by the Trump administration are tantamount to whitewashing the sometimes tragic history of the United States, and that all Americans deserve to know the full story. The next article is titled, Trump Says Reflecting Pool Waters Are Now Crystal Clear, written by Drew Pittock. President Donald Trump shared several posts on his Truth Social account July 5th, explaining that refurbishments at the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool on the National Mall are nearing completion and its waters are crystal clear. However, the posts he referenced were shared to X on June 17th, around the same time the Reflecting Pool was initially deemed complete. On July 5th, Trump posted a screenshot of an undated memo written by Greg Wisher, a critical minerals consultant and deputy assistant secretary at the Interior Department, to his Truth Social account. In the memo, which isn't on official letterhead, Wisher explains that thanks to advanced nanobubbler technology, the pool is crystal clear, and the National Park Service is vacuuming up the remainder of the dead algae. The vacuuming is the final maintenance step after refilling the pool, and will be complete in a few days, Wisher wrote, alongside photos of the pool and Washington Monument. The president also shared a screenshot of an X post from an Interior Department's press office that uses verbatim the same language Wisher used in his memo, as well as the same photos. However, that X post was originally published June 17th, around the same time that the project was initially declared complete. The Interior Department did not immediately respond to USA Today's request for comment on the older posts that the president shared. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum appeared on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos on July 5th. Burgum also said that thanks to the nanobubbler technology that he said hadn't existed before, the water at the reflecting pool is now clear. Stephanopoulos pressed Burgum on why the cost of the no-bid contract had ballooned from $2 million to more than $15 million while the pool still isn't fixed. Well, it's fixed in the sense that it's no longer leaking 45,000 gallons of water a day, Burgum said. He noted that the 350-foot gash in the pool's industrial liner, which Trump has cited on numerous occasions as the work of vandals and the cause of the reflecting pool's problems, is actually several smaller gashes that add up to 350 feet. The length, Burgum said, represents less than 0.1% of that industrial liner that's been damaged, while 99.99% of the pool bottom is perfect. Burgum said that the administration has visual evidence and eyewitness accounts of people destroying the pool. While some videos and photos have emerged of tourists touching the water, nothing has been made public to suggest that people sliced up the liner with razors or box cutters. On July 2nd, a grand jury indicted David Hearn, an Olympic canoeist accused of tampering with the pool. Hearn denies the allegations, saying he saw a piece of liner floating on the surface of the pool and merely touched it. Burgum said during the interview that he thinks the press should move on from the reflecting pool story, describing the renovations as a big success. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled "Johnson Reflects on Balance of Power," written by Francesca Chambers. It's a challenging time to be the nation's number three leader, even with House Speaker Mike Johnson's political party in command. Sometimes it's a challenging time because of that, with President Donald Trump testing and pushing the boundaries of executive power. Other times it's because of circumstances beyond any one person's control. Johnson reflected on the tug-of-war between the legislative and executive branches in an era of intense political polarization as he sat for an exclusive interview with USA Today on June 29th in the U.S. Capitol. "There's a natural friction that is there between the branches," said Johnson, a close ally of Trump. "Sometimes there's a tug and pull, and sometimes they work in coordination better." The voters chose to give Republicans control of the House, Senate, and White House in the 2024 election. And when the voters deliver that kind of mandate, and they deliver unified government to one party, there's an expectation, I think, that they will work seamlessly to fix the problems, he said. Johnson has had a front row seat to much of the turbulence and uncertainty that Americans have experienced over the past decade, from a global pandemic and a subsequent financial crisis to the 2021 attack on the nation's capital that saw Trump-supported rioters trying to force their way onto the House floor. He became House Speaker in October 2023, because of the acrimonious ouster of his Republican predecessor, former Representative Kevin McCarthy, by a hard-right faction of lawmakers. A constitutional lawyer for nearly 20 years, before he ran for a seat in Louisiana's state legislature, Johnson began his congressional career at the start of 2017, arriving in Washington the same month as Trump. The timing, he says, has helped the two GOP leaders understand one another. Now, that's not to say that I won't vigorously defend Article 1, Johnson said, of the part of the U.S. Constitution that lays out the composition and powers of the legislative branch. It's the most important. It's listed in the Constitution for that reason, to keep the executive in check. But, he said, a lot of the disagreements that we would have between the legislative and executive branch, we're handling behind the scenes, because that's how unified government works. Yet, more often than not, those disagreements have spilled into public in Trump's second term, as GOP lawmakers grapple with voters' expectations and a president who demands extreme loyalty from everyone around him. Is that kind of fealty what the framers of the Constitution had in mind? Johnson argued that the question is not unique to Trump. While loyalty is a premium to him, clearly, he openly talks about that. That's not unusual among presidents, Johnson said. He has a way of making demands that's very forthright, but he knows how to get things done. Johnson said Trump solicits counsel and considers counterarguments from his allies and advisors, including GOP members of Congress. But the president routinely makes demands of lawmakers in his party that run counter to their policy positions and backs primary challengers against those he deems insufficiently supportive. In June, Trump insisted that lawmakers in his party impose new voting restrictions by passing the Save America Act. Until he gets what he wants, Trump said he would not sign a bipartisan housing bill that passed Congress with overwhelming majorities. Republican lawmakers and Trump have also quarreled over the war with Iran and whether the president has a constitutional duty to seek approval from Congress for the hostilities. Johnson brushed off the skirmishes, broadly speaking, as part of the governing process. The friction has worked well, Johnson said of inter-party battles. It's led us to great outcomes. While voters put Republicans in control of Congress and the presidency, polls indicate they aren't too happy with their leaders. The president's approval rating was hovering around 38% in a June survey taken by Quinnipiac University, with independents and Democrats driving much of that dissatisfaction. Congress is doing much worse. A mere 12% said in a May Gallup poll that they were happy with the job being done by the legislative branch. Johnson's approval rating in a December survey was 35%. Public trust in American institutions as a whole, including the federal government, has been on the decline as political polarization spreads. There are many reasons for that, Johnson said, citing the introduction of the 24-hour news cycle, smartphones, social media, and an increasing online populace. We have challenges that are unprecedented that previous generations of Congress did not have to contend with, Johnson said. Let's be frank about it. It's been a toxin to our political system, and it makes things very, very difficult to get done. Johnson said in previous generations, Americans all received the same information. Now, he said, there are endless sources of information and algorithms designed to drive people further into their ideological corners. The polarization has coincided with a belief held by most Americans that politically motivated violence is on the rise. Trump has been the target of multiple assassination attempts. Conservative activist Charlie Kirk was shot and killed in 2025 while speaking on a college campus. A Democratic lawmaker in Minnesota and her husband were killed in their home. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, was attacked in 2022 by a hammer-wielding assailant. Johnson had a close brush with violence during the White House correspondents' dinner in April when a gunman opened fire in a Washington hotel. The speaker was in a hallway close to the area where the shooter was apprehended. I think people are prone to say crazy things, and when they see people in authority echoing those things, it tends to spur on violence, Johnson said. You can point fingers in all directions, but in a general sense, I think everybody needs to turn the volume down. The solution to hateful and divisive speech is not censorship, he said. I think the more that we have dialogue, the less we are prone to violence, he said. If you've missed any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. The next article is titled, Russian Military Strikes on Ukraine Kill at Least 20. Written by Valentin Ogarenko and Vladislav Smilinets. Russia hammered Ukraine with missiles and drones early July 6th, killing at least 20 people and exposing Kyiv's critical shortage of U.S.-made interceptors, officials said, just days after the deadliest attack on the Ukrainian capital this year. Rescuers were digging bodies from the rubble of a Kyiv high-rise ripped open in the overnight bombardment. The latest attack came on the eve of a NATO summit where President Donald Trump is due to hold talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a renewed push for peace. Ukraine's military was unable to down any of the 23 ballistic missiles fired by Russia, according to Air Force data, reflecting its increasing vulnerability to Moscow's strikes as stocks of its prized Patriot missiles run out. Zelensky has repeatedly pleaded for more interceptors, the only weapon in its arsenal that can shoot down ballistic projectiles, whose high velocity and steep flight path make them difficult to stop. He called for major decisions at the NATO summit in Turkey, which begins July 7th, to ensure Ukraine can defend itself. Ukrainian Air Force data shows air defenses shot down just 4 of 49 ballistic missiles in July. As long as Patriot missiles sit in our allies' stockpiles, Russia is only encouraged to keep destroying residential buildings, Zelensky said on X. The U.S. and Europe have the power to stop this terror. Ukraine intercepted 37 other missiles and more than 90% of the 351 drones during the July 6th attack, the Air Force said. At least 14 people were killed in Kyiv and 6 others in the surrounding region, according to officials. Scores more were wounded. Nearly 30 buildings across the city were significantly damaged, Interior Minister Ihor Klimenko said. A search operation dragged into the afternoon of July 6th as crews combed mountains of rubble and twisted metal in the multi-story building whose top floors had been torn open. Reuters television footage showed what appeared to be human remains trapped beneath concrete debris on an upper floor of the building. The July 6th attack came days after this year's deadliest strike on Kyiv, which killed 31 people on July 2nd. Russia's defense ministry said on July 6th that its forces had conducted a massive attack on Kyiv and other locations with long-range, high-precision air, land, and sea-launched weapons and drones. The ministry also said military and energy facilities were hit in Kyiv and its surrounding region, as well as military airfields in several other Ukrainian regions. Moscow has escalated an air war this year as its battlefield progress has slowed to a virtual crawl, hampered by Ukrainian long-range attacks on its military logistics and oil industry. Ukraine has also retaken territory in some areas along the 746-mile front line, despite Russia encroaching on the strategically important eastern city of Kostyantynivka. Zelensky, on July 4th, denied a Russian claim that the city had been captured. On July 6th, Kyiv's military said it had struck three Russian oil refineries, including the country's largest in Omsk, more than 1,500 miles away, as well as two Shadow Fleet vessels in the Sea of Azov. The next article is titled, Heat Wave Continues in Western States, written by Doyle Rice, Carissa Waddick, and Dina Voiles-Pulver. Although the deadly early July heat wave has shrunk significantly, dangerous heat is still the reality for parts of the country. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Weather Prediction Center, the oppressive heat that affected portions of the central and eastern United States last week will continue to contract through early this week as seasonable to below normal temperatures spread across much of the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Ohio Valley. The change will be accompanied by a slow-moving frontal boundary and areas of low pressure, likely causing multiple rounds of thunderstorms with the threat of flash flooding, the prediction center said. However, a new heat dome building between the Rockies and the West Coast is expected to bring sweltering temperatures to much of the West, according to AccuWeather forecasts. It will set up shop first in the Southwest and then expand toward the plains through mid-July. Las Vegas and Phoenix will be near the core of the triple-digit heat through this week and even beyond. The thermometer will also be high in places like Denver and Salt Lake City, where the 90s are forecast, according to AccuWeather. The heat will lead to more fires and smoke in the Rockies and high plains and poor air quality due to less wind flow, said AccuWeather lead long-range forecaster Paul Pastelak in an online forecast. Even northern Alaska had a heat advisory July 6th with a predicted high of 80 degrees. The normal July high temperature in Utqiagvik, formerly Barrow, on the Arctic Ocean is in the mid-40s. Record high temperatures in dozens of East Coast communities canceled festivities and sent hundreds to emergency rooms over the 4th of July weekend. New Jersey officials believe extreme heat has caused 25 deaths since July 2nd, the most reported of any state so far. Many of the victims were found in homes without air conditioning. A few were outside of their residences, some were in streets, and some were in parked cars, Raynard Washington, the commissioner for the State Department of Health, said in a July 4th news conference. The ages of the victims range from mid-30s to 80s. Dahlia E. Weiss, director of communications for the New Jersey Department of Health, said in an emailed statement. She stressed the data was preliminary. In Jackson, Mississippi, a 74-year-old man who had been reported missing on June 29th was found behind a gas station on July 2nd, but died on the way to the hospital. Local officials reported to the National Weather Service that the man had been exposed to extreme heat over multiple days. In Washington, D.C., where heat indices climbed above 110 degrees during President Donald Trump's July 4th Salute to America event, emergency service personnel reported 96 patient contacts and 40 patient transports from the National Mall, the National Special Security Event Joint Information Center said in a July 5th statement. The next article is titled, Israeli Strike Kills Four in Lebanon, written by Jana Chukir and Tala Ramadan. Four people, including a school principal, were killed in an Israeli strike on a vehicle in southern Lebanon on July 6th, Lebanon's health ministry said, in one of the deadliest attacks in weeks. The attack tests a ceasefire announced in June that has sharply reduced violence in southern Lebanon, the main arena for conflict between Iran-aligned Hezbollah and Israel, but not eliminated it entirely. The Israeli military said it had struck a vehicle carrying four people it said were approaching what it calls a security zone in southern Lebanon and posing a threat to its forces. The health ministry identified the victims as school principal Esperanza Gandur, her mother, a female domestic worker, and a male foreign laborer. Gandur had been checking on repairs at her war-damaged home in Nebatia and was on her way back when the vehicle was struck, a local source and Lebanon's state news agency said. At Najda Hospital in Nabatea, a health official told Reuters by phone that staff heard the strike before the victims arrived. We heard the explosions and saw the smoke rising, the official said. The strike took place in an area that local residents had considered safe from attack, he added. Israel has established what it describes as a security zone, extending about 6 miles into the southern Lebanon along the border, saying it is needed to protect northern Israeli communities from attacks by Hezbollah. Israeli forces remain deployed in parts of the zone despite the ceasefire, while Lebanon says the Israeli presence violates sovereignty. For residents, the attack shattered what little sense of security had returned under the ceasefire. Ali Safa, 32 years old, said his family had been back and forth, forced to flee the south several times since the truce was announced in late June. It brought the fear back all over again, Safa said, of the July 6th strike. Some of the few businesses that had reopened closed again because of the daily strikes, and some families left. There's always this small hope that at least you're back in your own home, but every day you wonder whether you'll have to leave again. Lebanon has borne the deadliest spillover of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran since Hezbollah opened a front in support of Tehran on March 2nd, triggering an Israeli offensive and ground incursion into southern Lebanon. The ceasefire was negotiated by the United States and Qatar with help from Iran. Tehran has insisted on a Lebanon ceasefire in its talks over ending the wider regional conflict, while Israel has scaled back attacks in Lebanon at Washington's behest. Israeli attacks have killed more than 4,300 people in Lebanon, according to the health ministry, which does not distinguish between civilians and combatants. On the Israeli side, at least 36 people, including 32 soldiers and 4 civilians, have been killed in the fighting, according to Israeli authorities. The next article is titled, "Ruling May Switch Cash Advantage," written by Nolan McCaskill. U.S. Senator John Ossoff of Georgia is a fundraising juggernaut, raising more than $81 million so far this cycle and holding nearly $33 million in campaign cash, or $30 million more than his opponent in the November election, Republican Representative Mike Collins. But Ossoff's financial edge in the state that President Donald Trump won in the 2024 election may have effectively been erased by the U.S. Supreme Court, which struck down limits on how much individual candidates could coordinate their spending with national political parties. The Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee, among others, will now be able to spend unlimited funds from their big donors in coordination with political campaigns. That could well tilt the playing field in favor of Republicans, who tend to raise more money from big corporate donors through national committees over Democrats, whose candidates tend to raise more money from small individual donors. While the national committees could previously spend on behalf of their candidates, party officials say the restrictions on coordinating their messaging and strategy with individual campaigns made that spending far less targeted and effective. Democratic candidates currently have a staggering cash advantage over Republicans in competitive Senate races: $16 million in North Carolina, $9 million in Ohio, and $8 million in Texas. Unlimited funds from the Republican Party's national apparatus, however, can now shore up lagging fundraisers such as Collins in Georgia and Texas's Republican Senate nominee, Attorney General Ken Paxton. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.